Okay, today is the time, and this is the place for administrative hearing dockets number 602 and 603 in the matter of the amendment of Part 6 of the Las Vegas Justice Court Local Rules of Practice relating to summary eviction, and in the matter of amendments to the eviction mediation rules for designated eviction proceedings. This matter was sponsored. But what are we hearing?
Lily?
Do you know what that is, Lily?
Yeah, like 30 seconds ago.
All right. Do we need the mics for recording, or can I turn them off? What does that mean? Yeah, we just got it. We just got those. Thank you. Another copy.
Thank you.
We just got.
You okay, Lily? Okay. Well, in any event, we're here today to hear and consider some administrative docket matters. There were petitions submitted by Judge Melissa Saragosa, and so, Judge, I'm going to have you come up, and if you would discuss, in particular, the latest amendments and just what version you want us to look at. I will say, at this point, that there was an amendment submitted several days ago, and I've extended public comment on this for another 10 days. The court will deliberate on these at the end of the public comment period. I'll also say that we've received all of the materials that have been submitted as part of our request for public comment. So in order to make this an efficient process, I will ask anyone that has submitted public comment, if you have something to indicate other than what's already in the written submission, I will welcome you to do that and give you a brief period of time to address anything that wasn't addressed in the public comment. And then as we get additional public comments in within the, throughout the next 10 days, the court will duly consider those before we deliberate. Okay? All right. Judge?
Thank you, sir. Chief Justice Perigree, members of the Supreme Court, both of these ADKTs really were born out of a desire to hold an eviction diversion program at the Las Vegas Justice Court, not pandemic related. The idea behind this program is that it would be something that would be sustainable. This is not at all related to COVID, CARES, CHAP, or any of the other pandemic-related issues. So I just want to kind of start with that as a concept. Our vision is really to build something that would be sustainable, internal, efficient, and expeditious. Summary, if you will. I want to offer some background information just to put the program in context. As many of you are aware, the Las Vegas Justice Court handles about 75% of the state of Nevada's summary eviction cases. In a typical year, the number of new filings has hovered around 29,000 to 30,000 new eviction filings per year for nearly the past 10 years, until the last couple of years. The past fiscal years, reported in the most recent Nevada Supreme Court annual report, the Las Vegas Justice Court had 43,902 new summary eviction filings. On top of that, there were an incredible amount, an additional number of reopened cases, almost 9,000 reopened cases. I can explain that a little further, but basically after a case has been decided upon, many of the tenants will file a motion to stay the execution or a motion to set it aside, and those are reopened. So there's a large number of those. So all in all, we're up to about 52,154 new and reopened cases last fiscal year. This calendar year, we are on track right now today, December 7th, to hit over 50,000 new summary eviction filings alone in calendar year 2022.
Sorry, say that again.
Over 50,000. We're on track by the time we get to the 31st of the month, we will likely hit 50,000 with no additional resources and no additional staff. The past 2 years have been extremely tumultuous for the Las Vegas Justice Court staff. With good intended federal moratoriums, a succession of changing governor's directives, mandatory external mediation programs, legislatively created affirmative defenses that require the court to take specific action based upon the status of a rental assistance application. Our staff has had to relearn procedures. They've had to work endless hours of overtime, often unwanted overtime, but they are troopers and they know that these cases are just going to pile up if they don't. Sadly, we've had resignation of staff. They're just exhausted. We must do better internally, and we know that. At one point, given the number of cases and limited resources, a summary eviction hearing in our court was being scheduled out 6 months. I'm not proud of that statistic by any means. We were setting cases in March and April of 2023. We've been working diligently to fix the problem. And part of the problem is Assembly Bill 486 requires the court to take action based upon the status of a pending rental assistance application. If it's pending, the case is stayed. If it's approved, the case is dismissed. If it's denied, then the case would proceed to a summary eviction hearing. And that would be great if we knew the status of a rental assistance application, but we don't. We don't. The only way that we find out with 50,000 cases this year is to send an email to someone at the Clark County chat program, give them a list of cases that we need to know the status and have them research each and every one of them individually, one by one, and send us a list back. That's how it's been for a year. It's unworkable. It's unmanageable. We've worked with them in the last couple of months to try to get a bulk list of approvals. We're trying to get a bulk list of denials, cases that we put on a stay. We don't have the time or resources to even go back and send them a new list to say what's the status of it. So they remain on calendar. We don't know what's happening with the application. So it remains on calendar. So what was happening is a week before any given hearing date, my staff would email the list of all the cases that were on calendar in the next week and say, please give us a status. They would give them the list. They would send it back to us. Those that were approved, we'd remove from the calendar. We'd go forward with the ones that were denied. But even when we removed them from the calendar, it was too short to reset another case. So we thought, okay, well, week's not good enough, right? We can't do anything to fill those spots. So we've been asking now for 45 days out. Tell us what's been approved. We can remove those from the calendar. Now we can fill those vacancies with new cases. That's where we're at right now. We've added some new calendars. We're now to January settings, probably end of January, however, giving time for the mandatory mediation portion of the case. So we're working on it. But it doesn't, I say that because I'm going to come circle back to that whole back and forth between the county and the court as kind of things as I continue my discussion and why we're working for this eviction diversion and what these rules have to do with that. So I'm trying to put these ADKTs in context. And with the passage of AB 486, all things changed for summary evictions. Most notably, we attribute the increase in summary eviction cases, this 50,000 number, not to more households being at risk of eviction. That's not what's happening here. Instead, they're repetitive filings involving the very same landlord and the very same tenant that are coming through our court over and over and over again. So I'll paint a picture of an actual case to put this in context. In case number one, a tenant, I won't obviously name names, was awarded 8 months of rental assistance on June 23rd of 2021 for rent covering December 2020 through July 2021. 8 months. Then the tenant failed to pay August rent. A second eviction case was initiated, so now we're at two. The case was stayed when the tenant filed a new rental assistance application. That application was approved November 17th of 2021, so the case remained stayed from August to November. It was approved, covered rent from August to December of 2021 for an additional 5 months, or a total of 13 at this time. The tenant immediately initiated a new rental assistance application and then failed to pay January's rent. A new eviction case was started in February, now the third. Same landlord, same tenant. And at that time, rental assistance would only cover 15 months. So when the rental assistance application was approved in February of 22, it only then covered January and February's rent. Then the next wave of money came through, authorizing payment of rental assistance up to 18 months. So now this tenant failed to pay March's rent in 2022, submitted another rental assistance application in April 22. Now we're up to the fourth new eviction. The tenant was only eligible for those final 3 months, up to 18 months. That was granted. But by the time that was renewed, more than 3 months of rent were due. So now this tenant has another eviction case, and they've exhausted funds, and we've done nothing to prevent that individual tenant from being evicted. Because at the end of the day, if they don't pay rent and they've exhausted their 18 months and the landlord proves their case of an unlawful detainer, the court has the obligation to rule in the landlord's favor. So with financial rental assistance having a place, it's not sustainable. I mean, it's just not. We know that rental assistance funds, CHAP funds, are coming to an end. The county intends to stop taking rental assistance. Let me rephrase that. They are going to stop taking a traditional CHAP application on December 31st. They will continue for whatever period of time, probably 10 to 12 weeks, to process all of the pending applications that are in the queue, which they anticipate will exhaust all funding for that CHAP program as it exists today. It will exhaust all of that funding. So in this scenario that I've just kind of put forth, you can see our staff has had to process five separate evictions for the very same tenancy. So that's when we say a new case, we don't believe that more households are being at risk of eviction, but just multiple cases are being filed with the same individuals. Because once that application was approved, the statute or the bill requires us to dismiss and seal that case. Each one of the cases required my staff to process all the administrative paperwork. Each one of those cases, they were checking for mediation resources, so we were sending it up to Homings Nevada for mediation. And the mediators, after AB 486 kind of came into play, were really no longer mediating cases. Instead, the mediators were monitoring rental assistance applications as well, because nothing better mediates a case than money. So the mediators were looking to the county. The last statistic that I heard from the supervisor over at CHAP is that Homings Nevada was putting 1,600 requests in a month for updates on the rental assistance application. So in addition to the court sending our list at 45 days off from a hearing, from a week out from a hearing, now the mediators were flooding them with inquiries on status of cases, status of applications, I should say. 1,600 a month they were fielding just from Homings Nevada. And the mediators, instead of being able to mediate matters outside of the realm of rental assistance, it got to the point where even if they had mediated a case or come to a settlement, they were unenforceable. Because if the tenant failed to comply with the settlement agreement and that tenant filed a new rental assistance application, the court was now locked in again to that spiral of rental assistance application. So even if there was a settlement, we weren't able to enforce with AB 486 measures in place. And I don't mean any of this to sound that I have an opinion one way or another on AB 486, except its impact on the court, because it really has just been administratively tremendous. And I think overall we need to do better. Now enter National Center for State Courts and their eviction diversion grant. We applied for that in hopes that we could do something better, that we could fix what had kind of gotten out of control for our court. We were awarded the grant. It was $1.2 million in funds by the Wells Fargo Foundation through the National Center for State Courts in an effort to do better. Preliminary discussions were entered into involving all of our players, all stakeholders in the process. Those discussions began, I want to say, around March of 2022 when we first learned that we had been awarded the grant. And we held monthly meetings. We held an all-day retreat in April of 2022 that included representatives from like I said, all stakeholders to include the Nevada Realtors and the then director of the Nevada State Apartment Association, whose name was Susie Vasquez. The discussions were productive. They were collaborative. Like I said, we held an all-day retreat with everybody over at the County Government Center. It included representatives from the county, from Civil Law Self-Help Center, Legal Aid. We drafted preliminary drafts of operating procedures to kind of see what it might look like on paper and look at the workflow, talk out job responsibilities of the various staff members that would be hired with this grant to run this program and that would be dedicated to the program. You were provided a copy of that draft procedure as part of some of the materials that Mr. Carsaz presented. That draft was abandoned shortly thereafter. We have never replaced it. We, in part, kind of relooked at the process, talked with the county, kind of tried to figure out how we were going to really make this eviction diversion program work. Another thing that happened over that summer is Ms. Vasquez resigned. And our discussions were attended then by Mr. Carsaz on her behalf. And we ended up spending an inordinate amount of time kind of recapping last 6 months of discussions. And I tried to hold that conference offline as well with the Apartment Association so that they were aware of where we were. Where we were then is different than where we are today. We did receive a 17-page letter that we reacted to. I wouldn't say I responded in a written letter back, but some of the issues were issues that are left for decision on a better day. Does the court have the inherent power in its own right to run a diversion program? Not for a discussion today, but those were some of the thoughts within some of the issues. Separation of powers, I respect that those were some of their issues, and I expect those are some of the things that you've read in the materials that were presented. What we decided at the end is to limit our program to rental assistance resources. Why? Because they are covered under Assembly Bill 486 that already exists. We are already mandated by this bill to stay a case when there is a pending rental assistance application. And it doesn't matter what that application is, whether it's with a government agency that's traditionally CHAP, or whether it's through county social services in a different program. It's not specified in that bill. So they have two additional programs that are unrelated to CHAP that we're focusing our efforts on. One is fixed income. An individual tenant who's on a fixed income who has their rent increased over the past 12 months, as we've seen with our economy, that's happened. Those individuals, because they never suffered a financial impact of COVID, would never be qualified or eligible for CHAP funding. They are already on a fixed income, and their fixed income hasn't changed, at least not due to COVID. However, the economy has changed around them, their rent has been increased, and Clark County Social Services has a special program with funding dedicated for those individuals. That's the one category, first category, that our eviction diversion program is focused at. In order to identify eligible tenants, we have proposed in our rules that they individuals are mandated to use our forms. Part of that reason is because we have a series of eligibility questions that are on those forms. And in order for us to identify eligible tenants, we need the tenants to use that form. We also have modified our notices to be easier to read. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. Many of you may have seen some of our notice forms. They had just gotten so lengthy. They're so wordy. They're written in such legalese that the average tenant couldn't read it or wouldn't understand it if they did read it. So we have spent a lot of time coordinating with the Civil Law Self-Help Center, who publishes our forms, to make sure that they're written at an appropriate level for understandability. We've run them through special software, things like that, to make sure we're using words that are commonly understood. That's another reason we want to mandate our forms. And that's part of our rules, and I think that's 80KT603 is our rules. It might be two. In any event, in response to the second category I want to talk about that we want to focus our program on is a funding stream that the county has for rental assistance that is limited to 2 months only. The eligibility criteria for that program is a change in circumstance that is limited in nature, because they will only cover 2 months of rent. And it is designed to cover a tenant who is otherwise in a stable situation, is, you know, has a financial income that is able to meet their rent, but for whatever reason they suffer something that sets them back. That could be a car accident. That could be car engine troubles where they had to make a choice to expend money on a vehicle repair in lieu of paying rent in order to keep their job and get back and forth to work. It could be a medical issue. It could be an injury, an accident. It could be a death of a family member. I mean, there's no limit really to what that emergency circumstance is, but the eligibility and the idea is you take an otherwise stable tenant who now finds themselves at risk of eviction because they've had a catastrophic or temporary setback. The county can fix it with 2 months rent and they're back on board and they're back paying their rent, and we will never see that case again in the system. That's the idea. So those are the only two categories right now that we have identified, and both are back to rental assistance. We would love to do better. Our original vision for our program, and we still are moving in that way, is that when we see that individual in the program, we will look at them holistically. We will look at their overall needs, their overall situation, what resources they need, what services they need. That is still the goal. We think we can start small and layer on to that. But a lot of that, truth be told, will have to come in this next legislative session and see what happens with our ability to continue with the eviction diversion program. That is our goal. Treat that situation holistically so that we never see that tenant again. We don't want the cycle where we have 5 eviction cases with the same landlord and the same tenant and ultimately end up with an eviction. It's not working and it's not sustainable. With those two main categories, that's it. I shouldn't even say main. Those are the only two categories of eligibility that we are starting with in our program now. So I hope that clears up any of the misunderstandings. So we drafted our rules. I provided a copy of those rules before I even filed the petition with the court to the Apartment Association, to their lobbyist, Mackenzie Warren. And that was probably around the 28th or 29th of August. I didn't hear anything back until I received a letter from Mr. K about a week ago. I scheduled a meeting with them immediately to address their issues and concerns. They noted to me that two issues that they wanted me to look at, and one was with respect to the summary eviction diversion program rule 6.8, where we had neglected to put a time frame in on when we would order a tenant to appear at the eviction diversion office. We changed that. That's one of our amendments that we would like you to consider. We want that to happen swiftly. So we are proposing within 7 to 14 calendar days. So immediately upon identifying an eligible tenant, we would order them to appear to the eviction diversion program. The eviction diversion program will consist of staff members, both county staff as well as court staff, that are dedicated to this program and this program only. So if someone has a rental assistance application pending for the fixed chat program, they will not have to wait the 10 weeks it's taking all the other applicants to get their application reviewed by CHAP. They will be reviewed in-house by our workers. They are county workers dedicated to this program, funded out of the grant. The program will consist of two eligibility specialists, 2 caseworkers, a supervisor, and our court facilitator, who is our civil division administrator. Those people will work physically located within the court. In order that we can share information, case manager and the eligibility specialist will be county employees, but they are assigned to this program and dedicated to this program. So we will eliminate this back and forth of emails, back and forth of, you know, getting information, because they will have access to their system directly. We will have access to the court system, all within one location. There won't be any need to have all of that cross flow of information. Additionally, we have mediation resources within the Neighborhood Justice Center. So for example, if needed, let's just take the fixed income chat program. If that's what the county is calling it, fixed income. It's not really CHAP, but it's just their name, I guess they're calling it. But for those eligible tenants, If they're on a fixed income, the county will help them with whatever rent they have due, plus cover them in the future for that increase of rent. So if their landlord increased their rent and their fixed income won't allow them to meet their rent, the county will pay that difference. But the county won't be able to do that indefinitely. The long-term goal, of course, would be to find a better solution, maybe find better housing, more affordable housing for that tenant. That takes time. It can't happen in a short course. So the county would step in to help them pay their rent until such time as they can either rehouse them, or they can mediate with the landlord. And perhaps the landlord's not aware of their fixed income situation and would be willing to negotiate a new lease agreement with not so high of a rental increase. So that would be the opportunity to mediate that case right then and there. And that kind of ties into my other ADKT, and that was, if we're going to have this program, it is easier for us to run it all together. And my ask was to exempt those identified for the eviction diversion program from the existing mandatory mediation program. Now, I recognize that that mediation program is limited to its funding. I'm aware of the funding issues that are out there, and that may be something that comes to an end naturally anyway. But right now, it is still, the rule is it's mandated. So we were asking in our second to exempt us from that so that we can evaluate those cases in-house. Both of the requests that Mr. Kay asked of the court, aside from, you know, the other discussions that are saved for another day and the separation of powers policy issues, the court addressed. We added the timeline in that they asked for, and we modified some additional language with respect to mediation at their request. So I was quite frankly surprised that when we responded with an amendment that amended what they wanted us to, that, and they've had this for months, that they asked for an extension of time, because I thought that we had a very productive meeting and had come to a resolution on those points. Nonetheless, if there are any other questions with respect to the rules, I don't think there's anything in there that is that I haven't already covered. The idea is use our forms. That's going to help us. The other thing with our forms, let me just add one other point on that. With 50,000 cases a year, somebody in my staff, and right now for all of those cases that go to a hearing, it's my clerk staff, for those cases that a tenant has not opposed and goes to a default review, if you will, it's our singular paralegal, one human being in all of the Las Vegas Justice Court who reviews all of the default summary evictions for our hearing master then to act upon. When the statutes that are in play require six different things to be in a notice, we know that if they use our notice, my staff can look at the form. They know it's the form. They don't even need to read the form. They can see, look, this is the form that the court approved in November of 2022. It's very easy for my court staff to review that and go through it. When a firm or a property manager or a landlord on their own creates their own form, even if it complies with the statute, we have to review. They have to read every single word of it, check off all the six things that are supposed to be in there. It could take 5 minutes to process that case instead of 10 seconds to look at it. Yep, the form's good. Move to my next check item. When you're dealing with the volume of 50,000 cases, it's critical. So for the love of my staff, I am begging, please mandate the forms, because it's just that important. I think that covers most everything. I'm happy to answer any questions. I apologize for the length, but I thought some background and history would be important to you making your decision on this.
No, and thank you. The background and history is important, and appreciate the presentation. Colleagues?
I have a few questions.
Justice Kadish.
Hi, Judge. Thank you for that presentation. That was very helpful for me, as not having been involved in this at all. That background is helpful. So let me, I guess, start with this, which is really sort of background, though. So the grant money What is that actually to be used for, and how does this relate to this program that's being proposed?
It's salary. The grant money is to fund the salary of the employees that will be dedicated to working in the program. So it's covering a legal office specialist, which is like our clerk, our records clerk level staff member for the court. It covers the eligibility specialists, the case managers, and supervisors. So it covers all of those staff. And the idea is that if you have dedicated staff to a program, they will be more efficient. It will be able to move those cases along much easier and faster and quicker than they would if they're standing in line at the traditional CHAP, which right now, as of last week, the CHAP program were reviewing applications or assigning applications to a case manager for review that were complete and in the queue September 13th. That's how far behind they are right now. So our goal is, if we have those that are not CHAP programs, but they're eligible for other rental assistance programs, we can pluck them out by eligibility criteria, get them into this program, and handle those in a far swifter fashion.
Okay. Thank you. And then, so the proposed eviction diversion program, at least initially, if I understood you correctly, would only be diverting cases that, based on the, I guess, the completed required forms in the eviction case, would either be eligible for this one program for the fixed income people or the other one that's a temporary, you know, 2 month assistance because of some temporary change in circumstance.
Yes.
Okay. And so, but is it contemplated that the program could be used for other potential rental assistance programs that you may learn about or may be created or available?
Absolutely. In Rule 6.8B, we left this intentionally kind of open because we know how difficult it is or how long of a process it is to get the petition for a rule change up to the court, get a hearing, wait the, you know, number of days. It takes a long process. So we do need the flexibility at the local level to deal with the county and other programs that may become available. It was our goal to try to catch more defendants or more tenants, excuse me, in the net, if you will, that would be eligible by reviewing notices and things like that. But the way our current statutes are written, if you're familiar with summary eviction, everything's backwards. Mm-hmm. the answer comes first and then the complaint comes after that. So until we get a tenant answer, we don't know whether they're eligible or not. So until our system might kind of become more normalized to a typical civil case, we have no other way of identifying eligibility at this point. Now, social services will help whoever comes. They don't have to have a case, an eviction case, but our program will be dedicated to cases that where there is an actual eviction case. But we don't know what funding might come down in the future for some new program. Mm-hmm. And if the county comes up with a new program once traditional CHAP is expended, then we want to have the flexibility to identify those people as well.
So have you looked at or has there been some examination of your existing caseload to get some idea of what percentage or what number of your 50,000 cases potentially would be part of this diversion program on these two categories?
Unfortunately, no. We have no way of gathering that data without doing an individual look at what we have, and the questions that we're being asked on the answer and information that the court has wouldn't glean that information. We wouldn't know if somebody was on fixed income, for example. Perhaps you could glean some of that from a from a informal pauperis application, but no.
But it sounds like these two categories are narrow, I guess, compared to the large numbers that you're talking about.
Correct. And that's the other reason for kind of starting small. We don't know. We might be flooded with people or we might have too few. We didn't want to overwhelm a brand new program and lead to an unsuccessful program that was just trying to, you know, stay afloat. We would rather start small, layer on as we can, and keep the program productive.
Okay. And then, so four cases that based on, so the tenant files an answer, and because of the answers given in that, they're deemed eligible for one of these two programs. So then what's going to happen with that case?
If they're identified?
Yes.
So the program would, the court would order that tenant to appear at an eviction diversion office within the Regional Justice Center. At the same time, we would schedule a typical summary eviction hearing in its normal place, wherever it would fall. Right now, that would be about the end of January, I believe. So within 7 to 14 calendar days, we would have a session set. It would not be a court hearing, but that's when the tenant would appear at the eviction diversion office, meet with the eligibility specialist, who would identify, you know, verify eligibility, first of all, identify resources and needs, and determine whether or not they qualify for this rental assistance program. If they qualify, sometimes they need to provide additional documentation, so that might need to happen within there. But we're trying with the order that we send to them to tell them to bring a whole laundry list of things with them to this meeting so that they'll be prepared.
Right
then and there, the eligibility specialist has the authority from Clark County Social Services to approve any rental assistance application on the spot. They don't have to wait in a line of 10 weeks to get their rental assistance application approved. Instead, if they've got all the material, then we will approve it right then and there. And now they don't write the check, of course, but they would be able to approve it right then and there, and they would then be able to authorize the check to be cut to the landlord. They would make contact with the landlord, of course, first, and, you know, verify they have to do there's a certain amount of paperwork that they do with the landlord.
Okay.
But that eligibility specialist would then reach out to the landlord and communicate what was happening with the landlord under the current guidelines of Assembly Bill 486, which mandates the landlord's cooperation at this point.
So if they're determined eligible, they're notified, there's at least under the revised proposed rule, they would have to appear within 7 to 14 calendar days. If they don't appear, then the case is already set for a summary eviction hearing and goes forward. If they do appear, it's evaluated if they qualify. And if they do, they can be approved on the spot. If they don't, it remains set as it
correct.
Would be.
And if they're approved, we would just, if they're approved and the check is cut, we would follow the guidelines of Assembly Bill 486, dismiss the case and seal it, and remove that from our calendar, giving us a free open slot for another case.
And is that all this happening, like when they go to meet with in this diversion office, I guess aside from rental assistance, is that person going to be talking to them about other available social services, wraparound services, whatever resources may be available to people in the community?
Exactly. Yes, all the above.
Okay.
And the beauty of that is they will have available their entire, you know, many tenants have an entire case file, if you will, with social services that is, you know, aside from just the rental assistance part of it. So the idea is that they would, there's a whole questionnaire, if you will, a lot of the data, obviously this is a grant, so we're going to be collecting a lot of data. So there are a lot of questions that are asked. We will identify through that eligibility specialist and case manager any other needs that can be met with any other services or resources that the county is aware of.
Okay. Thank you. Then my only other question, it arises from, if I'm understanding some of the objections correctly, and obviously we'll have an opportunity to hear from them as well, but where some of the previous issues, one like on the a hearing on a motion for stay, I think there was another category, but I'm not seeing it at this moment, where the prior rules that are in place talk about having a hearing within 7 to 10 calendar days, and now it would be changed to not sooner than 10 days. And I guess aside from whatever the appropriate time period is, I think there's an assertion being made that the statutes may require certain hearings within 10 days. Maybe I'm confused, but you, if you understand my question, can you answer it?
I will attempt to do so. Chapter 40, specifically the two sections that deal with summary evictions are 40.253, which is dedicated to non-payment of rent cases, and 42.54, which deals with all other types of summary eviction bases, if you will, and then points back to 253 for procedure. The statute requires the court to schedule an eviction hearing whenever a tenant has filed an affidavit opposing an eviction notice, regardless of what the affidavit says.
Right.
So they could literally sign the form and check no box on the entire form, and we still would read that to mean we have to hold a hearing, and we do. There is nothing in that statute that says when we would hold that hearing. In prior rules, local rules, we have self-monitored or put in a time period in place, and we've always been able to make that in the past up until the last couple of years when craziness ensued. And that would generally be 7 to 10 business days or 10 to 14 calendar days would typically be when we would have scheduled it. Now, our local rule does say unless there is good cause or, you know, unless the court otherwise finds good cause. Mm-hmm. Our proposal in this rule is to change that 7 to 14 calendar days to 14 to 21 calendar days for two reasons. One, I think that's more attainable even in our current climate. We're getting down, we're engaging in a whole different other things with the county. They've given us a long master list of approvals that we're using Excel to marry up to existing hearings and trying to get those cleared out. So I think that's attainable. But second, it gives us time for those cases to go over to eviction diversion and be resolved through eviction diversion prior to the date of the eviction summary or the summary eviction hearing. And honestly, the good cause is the number of cases and the lack of resources. We've nearly doubled our cases and have no additional resources. One human being in a hearing master cannot hear all the cases that are necessary. We're trying to add on additional resources. The county has not given us an additional hearing master. We're pulling from wherever we can.
Right.
So we just haven't been able to meet it. The only other place you've mentioned the motion to stay or set aside. There is no statutory time frame to set a hearing on those motions. We recognize these are summary proceedings and try to set them as quickly as we can, if they even need a hearing. Most of those get reviewed in chambers and ruled upon in chambers within a day. If they come in the morning, they're ruled on generally within 24 hours. And the hearing masters review those. If they feel that a hearing is necessary, it is scheduled for a hearing. And I would generally say they're usually scheduled. And we say not earlier than 10 days because we notify everyone by mail.
Right.
There's no other way. We do have an electronic filing system, but these are pro-per litigants and a lot of property managers who are handling these as the plaintiffs. The tenants don't have the savvy to deal with electronic service. They just don't. So we just are run by notice of hearings by mail at the address. So we need time to mail it. It's at least 3 days to mail and then to them receive it. And then they basically have a hearing within, you know, a couple of weeks. The idea.
Sure.
The concern I have is, and I appreciate your outline of the fixed income and then the two-month category, but when I look at 6.8, and it's kind of a core issue, is what determines eligibility for diversion, and that doesn't specify those two that you outline, and indeed it goes on to say it will be determined by the court, but there aren't standards for that, and may from time to time be amended due to capacity and available resources. So theoretically, we could say we're starting out with these two, but then you change the criteria, and it's everything.
Well,
so what is the standard? I don't understand it from reading these rules.
Well, I think that was in part my my comments regarding the ability to be flexible to a certain degree. And maybe that just comes down to trust, because we have to be flexible enough to be able to accommodate whatever the county has available in resources. And that's sometimes out of our control, but we can communicate with the county. The county says, hey, we're able to get this additional amount of money for X number of cases or eligibility criteria. And then we can make those adjustments. If we had to, with our rules, if we had to come back with by way of petition to the Supreme Court every time we wanted to change an eligibility criteria, it would take months to get there. I know everybody has a busy schedule, but when we submitted a petition on August 30th, now we have public comment until December 19th, and we have the mandatory waiting period before we can implement the rule. It's 6 months down the road. So we definitely don't want to have to come back for a local rule change every single time there's either a modification in criteria or the county has additional programming that becomes available.
But this doesn't even specify that there must be a county-funded rental assistance program that offers eligibility on defined terms. I mean, this could be for any reason as written.
I think that's a fair point. And I don't see any reason that we can't modify the language of 6.8B to just that kind of phraseology that you recommended, and that is that it be tied to funding. I think it was kind of, if you read through and you get to Section C, and we're talking about the rental assistance applications, and we specifically struck through CHAP or other available resources, that it would be tied to Assembly Bill 486, maybe that was just too subtle. And I can offer some amended language there.
So, and we're a bit confused on which drafts are which here for me, because you say you've taken out the CHAPS reference.
Yes, on page 5, yeah. Rule 6.8. If you look at subsection C2 on that second line.
Yep.
That's where I'm referencing. Do you have that amendment?
Which
is not our intention to, it is not our intention at all to include traditional CHAP applicants in this program. There's just too many of them, and we know that's coming to an end anyway.
But I guess when you're looking at that, though, even if you take that out, that is, I don't know. It just strikes me that it is so open-ended that if you look at it from the perspective of a court needing definitive criteria for both sides to know whether or not this is something that can alter the normal statutory coordinates that these proceed on, that it can't just be because I say so. It can't just be a declaration that even numbered cases will get eligible and the odd numbered ones aren't. I mean, there has to be some criteria.
Could I interrupt with a question? Judge Saragosa, you mentioned that AB 486 compels the court to stay proceedings in instances in which the tenant is eligible.
Yes, sir.
That's a state law.
Yes, sir.
And so the court, in advancing this program, is trying to avoid being caught in the middle, where on the one hand, state law requires you to stay the proceedings if a person is eligible. And if the time lapse for that eligibility, it delays the process, that's not on the court, that's just on the processing of their application. I think to address 6.8B, it might very well be that the eligibility relates to tenants who are eligible for 486 programs. We don't know what those programs would consist of. We do know that there are two now that are identifiable, but there may be others in the future that provide for rental assistance. That might be a way to focus the determination. But from the standpoint of the court, you're compelled to stay those proceedings if a person's got a pending application.
If they've raised that as their affirmative defense
exactly.
in their answer. Yes,
yeah.
sir. That's yeah. correct. So I don't believe it alters kind of the procedure that's mandated in statute
right.
because immediately upon getting a tenant answer, we schedule a summary eviction hearing.
Sure.
It's our hope that we can do something in the interim to get that hearing off calendar and
right.
resolve that case, never to be seen again.
Right.
I only hesitate in
if
using-
If there are no eligible programs, then this rule doesn't come into place.
Correct.
So at the moment, at least after the CHAP money runs out, you'll know of two that you'll have to at least consider if somebody's qualified for it. And those qualifications are being set by the programs that are established by Washoe or Clark County at the current
right.
time.
Right, and it's hard because in dealing with social services, sometimes eligibility, like I said, on the two-month program, there's no definitive eligibility, I guess, except for a very vague statement that someone has suffered a temporary setback, emergency that can be resolved by rental assistance funding not exceeding 2 months of rent. I mean, it's vague, but it's squishy at the same time. You know, the social services person can evaluate that individual tenant situation. They're never going to exceed the 2 months. That's a hard and fast rule. And the idea is, and one of the eligible pieces is that tenant has to be able to pick back up after the 2 months paid
mm-hmm.
and be a stable paying tenant. So I think we can work with that language, and I'm happy to give some proposed language. I hesitate making it solely surrounded AB 486 because it is definitively not our intent to pull every single tenant who's got a pending
right.
CHAP application into this program.
Right.
It would be overwhelming, and we don't have the ability to handle that volume. So we're trying to limit it, but be open enough so that if a new program were established 3 months from now to replace that, then we can work with that.
So, Judge, in the revised proposed rule that you submitted on November 30th, it looks like portions that were relating to assigning cases to mediation, you've deleted. So that is no longer part of your proposal, correct?
In this fashion, that is correct. And two parts to that. One, that was one of the requests of the Apartment Association that we
right.
discussed and worked on and I thought successfully negotiated between us. Their concern was that it would be too mandatory instead of based on circumstances. And we wanted to leave the ability in there that, you know, any, I have to find the part that we left mediation in there. That the caseworker themselves. So sometimes we know that these cases are money driven. If the 2 months, if the tenant is eligible for the 2 months, program and they get the check cut, they're approved, they get the check cut, there really might not be anything left to mediate.
Mm-hmm.
So it would slow the process down if a tenant checked the box, I want mandatory mediation, got to send it up to Home Means Nevada, who I understand is not even assigning mediators right now because there's no funding, and then they send it back to us and nothing actually gets mediated if the money's there. So there would be no reason to send that particular case to mediation at all.
Right.
It's resolved itself. But you might find another case, my example with the fixed income, where perhaps they want to talk to landlords, see if the landlord's willing to work with an individual who's on fixed income, who's otherwise been a good paying tenant and maybe just is a victim of economy, bad economy, and increasing rental rates. So there would be, the caseworker would be able to look at the whole situation, what needs, what resources are there, what services are there, and decide this case needs mediation and refer them directly to mediation. So we still have the mediation component to this program, but kind of the formalized rules and how that would take place, we just didn't feel that that was necessary.
So, but that would still be if, so I see under proposed rule 6.8C3,
yes.
where it says upon the recommendation of the caseworker, the case may be referred for mediation. Does that, if that happens, is that still contemplated as a mandatory situation where the landlord is compelled to go participate in a mediation on pain of not being able to proceed with summary eviction?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's all my questions.
Okay. Any other? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time today.
And just so we're clear, the matter that we're going to be deliberating on is the amended rules sent on November 30th letter.
Yes, Chief.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. And now I'm going to give an opportunity again, let me remind you, if you've sent written comments and you've got something in addition to those written comments that you want to address, or perhaps questions that we have asked that you need to elaborate, I'll offer that to you now. Is there anyone here interested in saying anything? Oh, go right ahead, please. If there's any in there. No? Okay. All right. I've got bottles too. Yeah. Would you rather have a bottle?
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Jane Suskind, and I'm here on behalf of the Nevada State Apartment Association. To provide some context, the association is a nonprofit organization that represents 67% of multi-housing landlords in Las Vegas, or 175,000 units. And before I begin my presentation, which will just address the amended language, I would just like to note on the record that we received the amended language on November 29th. Which was the day before we submitted our written public comments. So we've had some time to review, but we haven't had enough time to fully review it. And we will be submitting some additional written comments by that December 19th deadline.
Okay, can you make sure your microphone is on? I'm a little trouble hearing you.
Can you hear me better?
Yes. Now?
Okay.
Much better.
Sorry. Okay. And I would also like to note that we do appreciate petitioners' attempts to compromise and to talk to us and, you know, to attempt to address the association's concerns, but the amended language does not resolve the association's concerns. We're also concerned that these amendments were rushed through the process in a belated attempt to compromise, and they'll have unintended consequences that have not been fully thought through. And I think some of the discussions that we've seen already during this proceeding might indicate that and might show that these proposed rules as amended do not fully think about all of the policy and unintended consequences that they'll have. With that, I would like to start, and I know you've read the comment that we submitted, so I won't go through the whole history of separation of powers, but I would just like to say I disagree respectfully with Chief Judge Saragosa's comments that today is not the day to discuss the separations of power argument. I think that it is important that we do discuss it and that this is something that the court considers when determining whether or not to pass these rules. And it is our position, as we provided in our written comment, that the creation of an eviction diversion program involves value judgments that are more appropriately left to the legislative branch. And that this court's adoption of the rules through this administrative proceeding would violate the separation of powers doctrine. And something that I think we should
That wasn't your position when you submitted a letter in support of the grant request.
There are a few differences, and the grant request did not make
mediation. Did you submit a letter to support the grant request?
The Nevada Apartment Association did, yes.
Yeah.
There are a few differences between having a grant program that allows for mediation if there are two parties who want to mediate, whereas what we feel this program does, whether it's intended or not, it will force two parties who might not want to participate in mediation to still go to mediation. Mm-hmm. And that's not only a bad policy in our opinion, but it's also not something that the court can require two people to do.
Well, do you acknowledge that AB 486 requires the court to stay proceedings when someone has applied for a program?
Yes, but that, and I appreciate the concerns and the discussions about AB 486 that we've had so far in this proceeding, but it seems like all of those problems and all of those concerns were caused by AB 486, and the right place to amend those or to change and solve those problems would be to amend that statute, which is something that the legislative branch...
That might be true, but you've got a lot of cases coming in the door in the meantime.
I understand that.
So the court's got to deal with those.
I understand that, and we appreciate, you know, we appreciate that issue and problem, and we're feeling it too. There are members of the association who are waiting 6 months to have an eviction hearing, mm-hmm. And that's not a good situation for anyone to be in. We do recognize that, and we understand there are problems. Our position is that these proposed rule changes don't solve that problem, and not only do they not solve the problem, it would be inappropriate for us to be, for this court to make that change through an administrative proceeding, through the administrative docket, when the best place for those sorts of changes and policy discussions to happen would be at the legislative branch. And that's our position. And from what we've heard today, it sounds like this is extremely, you know, policy heavy. We're talking about different stakeholders and different policies and how that will affect different people. And in, you know, our democracy would require that those sorts of deliberations would happen at the legislative branch, at the legislative session, which meets in 2 months rather than today.
What authority does the court have to manage its docket, Ms. Suskin?
The court does, under NRS 2.120, the court does have the authority to manage.
What about the Nevada Constitution? Does that play a role in that?
Yes, oh, of course. Okay. Yeah.
I thought it might.
Under Article 6, Section 1, the court does have the authority, you know, to hear and resolve cases, and it does have the authority, and, you know, within that authority, it has, you know, inherent powers to manage its docket. And we recognize that, and we outlined in our written public comment the limits on that power, and the limits not only, you know, in the case law, but also the expressed limits in NRS 2.120, which would limit the court's power to exercise, or authority to exercise certain powers when doing so would be inconsistent with Nevada law, or when it would abridge, enlarge, or modify substantive rights. And we've outlined that argument in our written comment. So I would like to discuss kind of the amended language, which we haven't had the chance to provide written comments on. And I think I'll start with actually Rule 6.8, because that seems to be kind of the substantive rule that we're discussing. And I would like to start by saying that we have similar concerns as Justice Pickering's concerns with the language that, you know, provides the court with unlimited discretion to, you know, decide eligibility. That would, you know, kind of create this unclear and uncertain environment, which is one of the association's concerns. We also, for several reasons, believe that the amended language would be inconsistent with NRS Chapter 40. And NRS Chapter 40 provides the summary eviction remedy proceeding for landlords and tenants. And nothing in NRS Chapter 40 contemplates or requires a caseworker or a mediator getting involved in this proceeding or in this process.
So, and, Ms. Suskins, yes. If I can interrupt.
Yes.
So how would
requiring a tenant who's potentially eligible for a rental assistance program to meet with somebody, determine if they're eligible and able to get rental assistance, which helps pay the landlord, hurt the landlord?
So we're not saying necessarily that that's going to hurt the landlord. We recognize that we want tenants to be able to get assistance. Right. That's in everyone's best interest.
Right.
We don't think that as drafted, this language will allow for that to happen in an expedited manner or an expedited way. And we still think that as amended, the language in Rule 6.8 would still require not just a caseworker to help someone try and get rental assistance, but it would also require mediation in certain situations. And that would extend the process beyond what NRS Chapter 40 envisions and what NRS Chapter 40 authorizes. And
to be clear, yes. Chapter 40 does not require the court to set a summary eviction hearing once the pleadings have been filed, does it?
So NRS Chapter, and I'll look at 40.253, mm-hmm. subsection 6.
Mm-hmm.
That subsection does provide that a court should hold a hearing upon the filing of a tenant affidavit. And so there is a substantive right to a hearing after the tenant files an affidavit. There's nothing.
Go ahead.
There's nothing that provides for these additional steps. And
there's nothing in that language that requires a hearing to be set by a certain period of time.
No, there's not a specific date in NRS Chapter 40.
So what I hear the Justice Court saying with their proposal is they're trying to create a situation that allows for those summary evictions to occur earlier than what no program at all will cause, which is hearings being set 6 months out or 8 months out. I mean, when you've got a volume like this, that's what's going to happen in the absence of no action, isn't it?
I recognize that NRS Chapter 40, there's no specific timelines.
Could you answer my question? In the absence of something to try to help mitigate the docket, the court is faced with the very real possibility that summary eviction hearings are going to be set out. They already are. 4, 5, 6 months, even longer. All the while, the tenant is still in the property, not paying rent for whatever the reason may be, and nothing's being accomplished.
And if that is a problem, we recognize that problem. The fix to that problem involves multiple different considerations. There's multiple different things and policy issues involved in that consideration. And it would essentially be amending or changing NRS Chapter 40 or the law that was put into place with AB 486. And when we're talking about a legislative change, something that's going to change a law that was enacted by the legislature, it is our position that that should be done at the legislature.
But the tension that exists here is that we don't know whether the legislature would change it, would be amenable to changing it, or even how they would change it. But in the meantime, a court has to deal with its docket. And that's here and now.
And I recognize that. I understand that. The legislature meets in February. If we were talking potentially at a different year and it was an off year, we might be having a different discussion. But the legislature meets in 2 months. We're not in an emergency situation anymore. I recognize that when the court previously talked about changing the rules to summary evictions in ADKT 567, we were in the midst of a pandemic. There was an emergency, an emergency declared by the governor, by the president. You know, we were in a state of emergency. We're no longer in a state of emergency. That has ended as of May 2022.
You don't consider summary evictions being set 4 and 5 and 6 months out an emergency to your clients?
We're no longer in an emergency situation where the court would then have to step in and exercise its inherent powers to fix that emergency.
So just so I understand, one of the legislative aspects, you were saying there's no time set for hearings on the summary evictions. So one of the, I guess, fixes that you envision through the legislative process would be a set of time frame there. 10, 14 to 17 days, whatever it may be. Is that correct?
I think that's something that would be discussed at the legislature.
And then going back to the practical aspect of this hearing, what crisis the Justice Court is in trying to get these as they are set within 6 months, how is that going to happen? What does that look like?
That's a good question, and I don't have an answer, and I can't say here's exactly the right program which is going to make, you know, this the time period reduced to 1 week or 2 weeks. And that's the beauty of our legislative process, that I'm not the only one responsible for giving you a solution, right? You'll hear from all different interests, people who have specialized knowledge, people who will, you know, look at other states and how they've dealt with this problem. All of that's part of the legislative process, and that's what makes really good laws. That's why we think this sort of an issue, when we're dealing with an issue and we recognize that issue, we're feeling the effects of that issue. But that's, you know, exactly why we have a legislative branch who can hear from all of those different people who are more knowledgeable than me and make a decision about that.
Is it your position that there's some part of this proposed rule that is in conflict or is contrary to existing statutes?
Yes, and we outlined it in our previous written comments. Now that there's this amended language, okay, we do plan to show you the specific part of NRS Chapter 40 that we think this is in conflict with. But one of the specific provisions is NRS 40.253 subsection 6. And honestly, we think that it's contrary not just to the specific written language of NRS Chapter 40, but to the spirit of Chapter 40, which, you know, does provide for an expedited process for landlords and tenants.
Right. So is it your impression that having the tenant meet with this eviction diversion representative about potential rental assistance programs would delay the summary eviction hearing? Because that's different than what Judge Zaragoza told me.
Yes, and we think it could, and we think it would. And those sorts of questions, and I think I've made my point clear, but those sorts of questions are better left for the legislative branch. But we do think that by adding these different steps would delay the proceeding. And I would like to add that it's not just adding the step of requiring the tenant to meet with the caseworker, but if you do look at subsection C3, there's still a mandatory mediation requirement. And the way that I read this amendment is instead of having the caseworker decide, okay, we're going to refer this case to mediation and then it must go to mediation, I read this amended language to mean the caseworker can then give a recommendation and the court has the discretion on whether it wants to send it to mediation. But if the court exercises its discretion to send it to mediation, the case will go to mediation. And as drafted, that's what this language does.
And your point is that that would be an involuntary mediation. If somebody didn't want to go, they would still be obligated to go.
Exactly. And there's nothing in the proposed language that provides the landlord or tenant an opportunity to opt out.
Yeah.
I recognize and we appreciate the attempt to remove subsection, I believe it was D.
But your point is there's no exit ramp on that.
Yeah. And it kind of underscores a point I made at the beginning of my presentation, which was, it does seem like this language has been rushed through. And in that process, there are unintended consequences and some places that are incomplete. And so as drafted, this language would require mediation. It doesn't provide the landlord or tenant a way to opt out of that program. So under this amended language, two unwilling parties would go to mediation, potentially not in good faith because they didn't want to mediate the case. And it would hold up the eviction case or the eviction hearing for additional time.
But you agree with Justice Kadish that the referral to a mediation officer in and of it, or not a mediation officer, but a caseworker to evaluate eligibility is not in and of itself a time drag?
Respectfully, I don't know if I would fully agree with that statement. It's unclear based on this drafted language how long that would take. I know Chief Judge Zaragoza made some comments today that it would take a certain amount of time. There'd be a limited amount of time. That's not reflected in this language, and that's concerning to us because as drafted, it's an indefinite amount of time.
And it's out of whatever the long the period is that would otherwise get you to court.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that language... that language potentially could be crafted where it could be somewhat acceptable if it had a time frame.
That's not our, that's not our only concern with mm-hmm. the language.
And then if you put an off ramp into C3, that would also alleviate some concern there.
If can you repeat that?
If you put an off ramp on C3, the referral, the case may be referred to a mediation.
In my opinion, the change from will to may did not remove the mandatory
correct,
nature of
but
mediation.
There could be additional language added that may provide an opt-out.
Again, I don't think that would solve all of our concerns. Mm-hmm. I don't think just adding a sentence that said a landlord can opt out would solve our concerns that this language and this proposed rule is contrary to statutory law. That wouldn't resolve our concerns that this would still extend the proceeding and potentially do so indefinitely. And it wouldn't solve or resolve our fundamental concern that this sort of a question is better left for the legislative branch, which meets in February.
Okay. Any other questions? Mm-mm. Oh. Okay, thank you very much. And Judge Zaragoza, I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond to a couple of those questions that the court had asked. I'm going to give Judge Zaragoza an opportunity to respond while it's still fresh.
I guess I could just start with that last part about talking about the mediation program. Existing law in Assembly Bill 486 already mandates mediation through the Supreme Court's mandatory mediation program. Now, we know we've had a conversation about the potential lack of funding that would keep that program moving forward. That already exists today. So the statute requires the court to set that or stay, if you will, a summary eviction hearing for not more than 30 days, if we could make that happen, of course, to accommodate the Supreme Court's mandatory mediation program that was passed during the pandemic. So we're working under that guideline right now. But even setting all of that aside, since the Neighborhood Justice Center has been in existence, the Las Vegas Justice Court has been referring people to mediation in all kinds of cases. We do it in small claims cases. We do it in eviction cases that come to our attention where it looks like the parties might be able to mediate. It's never been mandatory. Ever. We've been doing it since I've been a judge for the last 15 years. To argue that the language of someone may be referred to mediation is mandatory is just contrary to the plain language of the rule.
Well, I guess the point was if the court does refer it, then it is essentially mandatory.
I disagree. Yeah. That's okay. Why we used the word may. We can refer it. And I think within the rule itself, in 6.8, while there is, if you will, I don't want to call it punitive, but if you will, we did put in our amended language of 6.8 that if the tenant fails to cooperate with the caseworker, then the case would be removed from the diversion program and proceed to the summary eviction hearing. So, I mean, the reality is if the tenant doesn't want to cooperate in mediation, then they're just going to go to their summary eviction hearing. I think the same is true. If landlord doesn't show up to mediation or doesn't want to participate, we're just going to go to the summary eviction hearing and resolve the matter on the merits.
But this doesn't say that. And expressing the one without expressing the other is a problem as far as interpretation. And the may refer refers to the discretion of the court to refer it, not the discretion of the parties to opt out. So it's a drafting issue. If what you mean by this is the caseworker may, on the recommendation of the caseworker, the court may refer it to mediation, and that if the court does that, either the tenant or the landlord has the right to say, I don't want to go there, I want to go to the summary hearing, then that's honored. If that's what we mean to say, then we need to say that.
I don't disagree with that.
Thank you.
I mean, conceptually, I guess, as I was talking about, we refer people all the time. We've never made it mandatory in any way. And we certainly didn't intend to be that way now. And that was the entire discussion that we had with Mr. K and the Apartment Association in the Zoom call that we had that led to this amended change. It was the entire conversation. It is not the intent to be mandatory. So I think we can clean that up.
So you just clean that up and you make it reciprocal.
Were there other specific points that you wanted me to respond to? I'm trying to remember what they all were.
No, if you had something that piqued your interest, I was going to give you an opportunity. But let me take some more comments and then as...
The only other thing I thought of was in terms of the timing, that was the other issue that the Apartment Association brought to our attention, and that's why we did specifically put a timeline in for referring an individual to the Eviction Diversion Program and a timing for the hearing that would be set at the time the answer is filed. Mm-hmm. And remembering that it's a little bit backwards with summary evictions in our current procedures, the answer comes first. We intend to schedule that person for eviction diversion before the landlord even files a complaint. It is quite possible that if the tenant appears at a eviction diversion program and they're eligible for assistance, the landlord never even have to file the complaint, which would save them the filing fee altogether. And that could happen in short course. I would appreciate any opportunity. I'll just take some notes.
And it would improve your statistics. It would improve your statistics as well.
Well, we'd still open the case with the
answer, with the
so
answer.
We call it an open case.
Okay.
But, you know, we would certainly lose funding for the Neighborhood Justice Center and so on.
Okay, anybody else have comments apart from the written comments? Mm-hmm.
By way of introduction, my name is Kirk Williams. I'm corporate counsel for a property management company representing several different companies that have 2,220 apartment units in Clark County. I had a whole speech prepared, but I'm just going to
Did you submit written
I did, Your Honor.
Statements? Okay. And
there is
I
a written
see
comment
on the speaker
from me.
List, but,
I was the first to file one. And the point I wanted to make is the problem with the entire proposal is that 486 is temporary. They're basing the creation of a permanent eviction diversion program on a law that expires on June 5th, 2023. It expires. And they're going to create a whole new courts program for a problem that goes away in 6 months. Okay? The delay that the court is currently facing, and it is exactly what Judge Hardesty put, it is amazing. It's a catastrophe right now. It's setting a case in an eviction, summary eviction matter, 5 to 6 months out. That goes away.
To be fair, Mr. Williams, the problem of eviction issues in 50,000 cases isn't going away in 6 months. Maybe 486 does, but the problem of the eviction issue isn't going away.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, and let me explain why. Prior to Assembly Bill 486, they were handling 30,000 eviction matters, and every one of those were being resolved in approximately 1 month's time. From the time that was our notice, our 7-day pay, rent, or quit notice was filed, until the time there was a hearing, it was 1 month. Okay, that is not the problem. The problem is that Assembly Bill 486 comes in and says you must stay the matter to give the tenants time to get rental, to seek and obtain rental assistance. Okay? So eviction matters are getting pushed out 4 or 5 months so that the tenants could seek and obtain rental assistance. Well, the problem is they weren't doing that. They file into the system, okay? They submitted into the system an application, and they don't complete the application until they go to mediation. And the mediator informs them, hey, you don't have a complete application on file. So now the hearing, you go to the hearing 5 months after it was set, and the court says, well, it stayed. So now a landlord has to wait 8 months to a year to get a case resolved.
Why wouldn't this be far more beneficial to you, this proposal?
Oh, okay. Please understand, landlords have no problem with somebody going in and going to somebody to talk to, getting rental assistance. We think that's a great idea. What we don't want is a mandatory mediation part where the mediation is completely worthless in eviction, summary eviction cases, in almost every case, because the facts are known.
But as we were just discussing here a minute ago with the diversion program and language that could be crafted that doesn't make it a mandatory. I don't know how you see that it's a mandatory mediation from a referral.
Okay. It was mandatory. It used to say mandatory when I read the first draft. So it changed. So forgive me for that point. If it's voluntary, then landlords probably not participate in it because they just want the rent. And
right.
And that's
What if they don't have to participate? What if they're not mandated to participate?
Then the problem I have with the system is this, okay? The court is creating a brand new eviction program that benefits tenants, and they're using Assembly Bill 486 to do that. It looks like the court is taking sides in every single eviction matter. And there is no standards. I'll tell you what. So if the court is running the program, okay, the court officers are running the program where they're telling them, apply for rental assistance, do this, do that. Slow down the process. It seems like they've taken a side instead of being.
How is the program to get rental assistance, which gets landlords paid, a tenant-focused program?
Okay, because it doesn't work that way. Most landlords in eviction summary, the reason why summary eviction is important to landlords, the benefit is we get our property back so we can re-rent it to another person who's paying. The benefit for tenants for summary eviction is they don't get a monetary judgment. Okay, so we just want somebody in that apartment who will pay rent.
Right.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, had you finished your response to Justice Kadish?
Well, you raised your hand, so I pretty much finished.
I apologize.
No, that's all right.
I didn't want to interrupt you to finish your answer to her.
That's all right. I couldn't remember if I was going to say what else I was going to say, so it's finished now.
Well, if it comes to mind, maybe you can add it. I wanted to circle back to the premise that you started with, which is the court building a program around a statute that's going to expire in June of 2023. I can appreciate that everybody wants to be prescient about what the legislature is going to do. I'll just speak from my own personal experience. Anyone who predicts outcomes from what the legislature is going to do in any given session is foolish. Just as much as this statute might expire in June of 2023, it could equally be extended for another 2 years. And that's it. All I'm getting at is that in the meantime, you've got a court overwhelmed with cases that is trying to get them to summary eviction hearings quicker than if nothing happens. And that's, I think, a legitimate concern for Justice Saragossa and her staff.
I agree, Your Honor. I will say that Section 9 of AB 486 mandates a sunset date of June, so it will take an act of the legislature to extend.
Right, but we all know what happens in the legislature
on
a variety of topics, and frankly, as much as one might argue that there's going to be changes or that there'll be some other approach taken or stakeholder participation that produces some panacea, it could equally be that the statute gets extended. So what I'm getting at is, in the meantime, what we need, what that court needs to deal with is processing these cases and finding a way to get both parties to a summary eviction hearing sooner than doing nothing will produce. And by the way, if nothing is done, what I suspect will happen is come June, instead of a 4-month delay in summary eviction hearings, it'll be a 10-month delay. Now, maybe after another 2 years, by the time you get to the next session, it will be, that will have mitigated, but who knows?
Hard to summary.
So all I'm saying is, when we're talking about rules, and one of the benefits, frankly, of having the Supreme Court adopt rules is this court meets every day of every month of every year, not every 2 years for 120 days. So you are far more flexible to deal with the facts as we know them rather than the facts someone might predict.
I understand and I appreciate the comment. I personally know that because CHAPS is out of money,
yeah,
right, well, they're not going to do anymore.
Mr. Williams, I think we are coming up to the worst of all possible situations. The money's running out. There are no programs to replace it. The caseload is enormous. You've got a statute that requires the court to honor a stay for an eligibility program that doesn't exist for at least the next 6 months. We couldn't be in a worse situation. That, to me, from a judicial standpoint, and recognizing a sincere effort to try to get these cases resolved as quickly as possible, warrants some effort in the interim.
Could not disagree at all with your comments, Your Honor.
And I can only tell you, as a person who sat on phone call after phone call for the past year and a half or 2 years, it is enormously frustrating, and I'm sure it is for your clients, to see how difficult it is to get a bureaucracy to get money out to people. I mean, I've lived it, I've watched it.
The fastest thing that could do for landlords is get rid of a mandatory mediation process so the courts can set cases sooner and quicker. That would help tremendously solve that problem. But there's a couple concerns, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. How does the court fairly decide who should participate in the eviction diversion program? How do they fairly decide that? Mm-hmm. There's no money, right? The $1.2 million grant is being used for salaries is what I just found out. I thought it was going to be used to help people who needed the evictions, but apparently it's going to go to salaries. Okay. Who makes up the eviction diversion program? It doesn't currently exist. Who is going to run the eviction diversion program? Is a court going to run the eviction diversion program? That seems contrary. It seems like the court is actually taking sides. How long will the process take? How long will the mediations take? Where is the money coming from? How long will the money last? How does court ensure all parties have equal access to the program? These are just some of the questions when I read this draft that was circulated. There's so many questions, and I think Justice Pickering hammered it home when she asked, what are the standards? How long will it last? There's no end date in this. If you're going to use AB 486 as the standard, then that time deadline should be based on however long there's money. Put something in there so that it's not in a perpetual new program that may not have the money to support it. Those are just some of the comments. I believe that if AB 486 does go away, the backlog of cases will go away in a real short period of time. Okay, because they're no longer having to mandatorily stay cases so that tenants can apply for and obtain rental assistance. That delay is caused by AB 486. It's what's caused 5 cases being filed against the same tenant. gets 4 months of chaps on this one, and then the next one, and then the next one. So you're constantly refiling. You know the cost of refiling, court costs, and the service costs, and all those things just keep going up because we just keep delaying the process. The bill is due. It is here. And we've got to pay it sometime. We should pay it now. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, anyone else?
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Berigarian, honorable members of the court. I did submit, we submitted written comments.
Thank you.
So I'll keep this brief.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Jonathan Norman. I'm the policy director for the Nevada Coalition of Legal Service Providers, which includes the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, the Senior Law Program, VARN, and Northern Nevada Legal Services. You know, the backdrop of this crisis is the COVID-19 pandemic. And as we came out of the pandemic, our community faced rising rents, 20 to 30% increases in monthly rent. And I think community leaders came together recognizing that something needed to be done to deal with the crisis that we're about to face as CHAP sunsets. The CHAP program, which has served as the safety net for so many, will stop taking applications on December 31st of this year. At the Civil Law Self-Help Center run by the Legal Aid Center, we're assisting 1,000 people per week. 90% of those people are seeking assistance because they're facing eviction. With CHAP ending, we expect those numbers to increase in 2023. When we were grappling with this issue, the question is, how as a community are we going to help an 80-year-old who's on oxygen, who gets a lockout notice? What options do we have at that point? We need an opportunity for Clark County Social Services to intervene so that a senior, our neighbor, isn't put out into the street in what would inevitably be a life-threatening circumstance. That is the reality facing the most vulnerable Nevadans. I was listening to a public comment at one of the state legislature's intern committees. It was an older gentleman. He had moved here with his brother years ago. They're both elderly. He was in a wheelchair, and he referred to his brother as disabled. He said in unadorned language, "If we become homeless, we will die." There can be a lot of hyperbole around issues like housing, but there was none in his demeanor, just the unadorned truth and the fear. The Diversion Court program was built with the 80-year-old on oxygen in mind. It was built with this man afraid for his life in mind. The program diverts eviction cases for our seniors and neighbors with disabilities who are on fixed incomes to a diversion program where they wrap in services, assessed for rental assistance or rehousing where appropriate. Warm referrals to nonprofits, the opportunity to sit down with a legal services intake advocate to complete a legal needs assessment. The barrier to them paying rent may be another legal issue. They may be drowning in medical debt. Legal services has tools to help with those issues as well. The eviction crisis impacts every program providing legal services in Clark County, from seniors stretching fixed incomes to meet rising rents, to families interfacing with DFS because they are homeless, to kinship caregivers struggling to stay housed. Prior to becoming the policy director, I was a CAP attorney. I represented kids in foster care in Clark County. Nothing increases that interface with Department of Family Services more than being homeless. I mention this because the second group that the Diversion Court is going to address are parts of our community that have had an emergency, where they've fallen 1 to 2 months behind on rent. If we can just get them righted, then we avoid all the cascading consequences that come with homelessness. And we see that every day throughout legal services across the board, whether that's in guardianship, Children's Attorneys Project, the consequences are just catastrophic. The Nevada Coalition of Legal Services Providers were obviously in support of the Diversion Court and the rule changes necessary to help that program flourish. Thank you for your consideration.
Okay, any questions? Thank you. Anyone else?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
I am Shay Dignan. I'm currently the Community Justice Fellow at Legal Aid Center. What I have to say is largely different from our submitted written comment, but very brief. So I'm here today to kind of zoom out and give context about the many other court-run, court-adjacent, and often court-established eviction diversion programs across the country. Eviction diversion programs, like the one proposed, have actually become a nationally recognized best practice for avoiding massive homelessness crises and keeping people housed. In 2021, the Department of Justice directly called on state courts to use eviction diversion strategies and programs to prevent mass evictions. Earlier this year, just a couple months ago in August, the White House and the Department of the Treasury hosted a summit called Building Lasting Eviction Prevention Reform. And the Department of the Treasury has also created an extensive online tool for jurisdictions and courts who find themselves establishing diversion programs through federal money or otherwise that will, quote, identify improvements that will facilitate increasingly robust, comprehensive, and effective approaches to ensuring housing stability within their jurisdictions. And then finally, as you know, the National Center for State Courts has also demonstrated a pretty big commitment to court-led eviction diversion programs through the grant that the Las Vegas Justice Court received. The point of all that is the national conversation that's happening about eviction diversion programs is not about temporary solutions. It's not about going back to the way things were before COVID. The ABA and the Harvard Negotiation and Mediation Clinical Program together published a report in June of last year titled Best Practices for Court-Based and Court-Adjacent Eviction Prevention and or Diversion Programs. The report identified 47 formal programs that were court-led in 30 states. That was a year and a half ago, eviction diversion programs. The existence of that report, the report doesn't mention separation of powers or any of that. The existence of the report is a pretty sound answer in my mind to that issue. But in any event, at the White House summit in August, the findings of fact included that approximately 180 jurisdictions in 36 states developed or enhanced eviction diversion programs with emergency rental assistance money in the past couple years. Not temporary eviction crisis solutions, not throwing rental assistance at the problem, eviction diversion programs, 180 in 36 states. These programs don't just look good on paper, they work. So three quick examples of truly dozens, I could give many court-established and court-led. In Philadelphia, they have a nationally allotted mediation-based program. More than 3,000 landlord-tenant pairs have participated in the past couple years. 80% of those cases are being resolved out of court. The First City Court Eviction Diversion Project in New Orleans won the Louisiana State Bar Association's 2021 Legal Services Innovation Award. It was headed by Chief Justice Veronica Henry. In New Orleans, it's a city where over 50% of the residents are renters. Similar to Las Vegas, we have a lot of people renting. Over half the residents there rent. Over 500 households, so not tenants, households, were able to avoid the eviction process in the first 9 months of that program. And it was established last year. It was established after the ABA report came out. And avoid the eviction process doesn't necessarily mean avoid leaving the property, doesn't necessarily mean you staying in the home, the landlord getting nothing. It's just 500 households were able to avoid going through the courts because mediation works. Texas, most notable example, in my opinion, has a statewide interagency program led by their Supreme Court. Chief Justice Nathan Hecht of the Texas Supreme Court was recognized by the Department of Justice by name as a leader and early adopter of eviction diversion as a vital solution to the imminent threat of an eviction crisis. So these examples are just a quick highlight. There's truly dozens. I highly recommend the ABA report with Harvard. But that report is no longer exhaustive. Like I said, Louisiana didn't have any eviction diversion programs before last year, and it's not included because it's so new. They're truly popping up all the time. So the opportunity that the Las Vegas Justice Court has been given by the NCSC grant, which was also given to Alaska, Kansas, Tennessee, is one to introduce eviction diversion as part of the solution to a crisis that hasn't ended. For tenants, the emergency is not over. I've spent several days in the Civil Self-Help Center, several full work days, and the emergency is not over. And stands to get a lot worse when CHAP dries up, which is notably before the legislative session starts. So I hope that's a little helpful. There's a lot of literature out there, but thank you for your time.
Thank you. Can I ask you one question?
Yeah.
You mentioned a whole bunch of states that have these eviction diversion programs. How many of those do you have an idea? Do you have a picture? How many of those have been legislatively authorized? And we have foreclosure mediation. We've done all kinds of different programs that the court has assisted in writing rules. But how many of these programs are legislatively directed?
Very few. I can think of, I can't remember which one it is, but one in the report, the 47 court-based and court mediation formal programs across 30 states, that was kind of at the advent of COVID. That was after emergency rental assistance money came through. They were definitely not all legislatively approved. The 180 that have popped up in 36 states in the past couple years.
So was a lot of that during COVID then? And that was what drove that. And during that emergency period in COVID, when the courts were entering emergency orders every day.
Absolutely.
Justice Pickering was Chief Justice during COVID, so that's what she did daily, issue emergency orders. And so is that where these programs?
The ABA report, that 47 was ones that have been established with emergency rental from the CARES Act and whatnot. So the 47 in the ABA report are court, they're not legislatively established. So that, I've read the report, there's no separation of powers argument in it that I can deduce. So yeah, the one example that was legislatively established was notable because it was either an informal, like a county established or a court established, I can't quite remember, that was codified into law during the legislature. It wasn't a brand new program that the legislator wrote. And I'm happy to find that information if the court would like more.
Thank you.
Can you spell your name?
Yeah, S-H-A-Y. And the last name is Dignan, D-I-G-E-N-A-N.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, anyone else? All right. Colleagues, do you have questions for anyone in particular that you'd like to hear from again? No? All right, then this has been very informative. We thank you for your participation. We thank you for being here today. We will take this matter as submitted pending the comments that will be forthcoming. The court will at some point after that deliberate on this. So this matter stands submitted. The court stands in recess until the next call of the court.